From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we hear from a former NAACP Youth Council commando who took part in Milwaukee's Fair Housing marches. Then the latest Listen MKE addresses the rise in car thefts in the city.
We have a lot of resources for what I would call low to moderate risk kids in the Milwaukee area. We have next to nothing for high risk kids.
Plus, look at how a major loss in tribal gaming revenue could impact Wisconsin's local governments.
When you're talking about smaller local governments, there's certainly the chance for these to be, you know, substantial impacts. When there is a compact in place, it's a substantial loss of revenue to certain local governments for sure.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we hear from a man who organized and took part in Milwaukee's Fair Housing marches. The Milwaukee County District Attorney addresses the rise in carjackings. We'll look at how a major decline in tribal gaming revenue is affecting Wisconsin's local governments, and Fit for You explores seasonal affective disorder and how to treat it. In honor of Black History Month, we're highlighting some of the significant moments of Black history here in Milwaukee. That includes the Fair Housing marches of the 1960s that brought together the NAACP Youth Council Commandos, Alderwoman Vel Phillips, and Father James Grappi. The groups gathered for more than 200 consecutive nights of marching to end housing discrimination. The Reverend Joseph Baring was one of the commandos. Commandos wore black berets, black boots, and sweatshirts with the word commando on them. Baring knew he wanted to join, and he would eventually become the unit secretary. Baring spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about his time as a commando in Milwaukee and his involvement in organizing the Fair Housing marches, which included the historical march across the 16th Street Viaduct.
People today, unless you really knew the history of Milwaukee, didn't really realize that when you cross that 16th Street Viaduct, that was the same as you crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge. The Menominee Valley down below, the railroad tracks and all of that, that separated, it was really the Mason-Dixon line. That separated North Milwaukee from South Milwaukee. And many people today would think it was strange, but you could not really, the only reason you were in South Milwaukee is if you were working. So years later, I worked for Nordberg, which was on Oklahoma on the South side. But if you were black, you weren't to be caught over on that South side at night unless you were working. And if you were working, you needed a car to get out of that place, because if you were standing on a bus stop, you were in danger of being injured or killed over there.
So basically the South side was like a sundown town. If you were black, you needed to be gone by the time it got dark outside.
You didn't want to be over there, even after 68 with the open housing law being passed. You still had that problem with the South Side.
But even knowing the South Side's reputation, you all still took some of the fair housing demonstrations to that side of town. How did we get to crossing the 16th Street Viaduct?
You have to look right before you got to the marches. See, the Youth Council had already been demonstrating. They had a club, the Eagles Club, that was all white. Judge Serafin, Mayor Henry Meyer, all of the white prominent power in Milwaukee belonged to that white club. Judges, but no blacks were allowed to belong to that club. So the Youth Council had been picketing the Eagles Club, and it caused some problems. The NAACP headquarters had been bombed in 66, and we had the Freedom House on Fifth Street at the time. They moved the Freedom House to 13th Street, right between, I think it was Valete and Cherry. We had the new Freedom House, and the commandos protected the Freedom House. The Freedom House is where we gathered for all the strategy for these marches. And we were marching in the city, going through the city, and we picked up so many people, blacks and whites, clergy, in these marches, these demonstrations to protest open housing. Mayor Henry Meyer said that he would never pass an open housing law where Black people could have the opportunity to live anywhere they wanted to live in Milwaukee. Police Chief Harold Breyer, a strong racist, was against Blacks living anywhere. And so they pressed it. Bell Phillips, the only woman on the Common Council and the only African-American, she would continue to push this bill for open housing and nothing was happening. Mm-hmm. They would vote against her every single time. So she got the idea that maybe if I got with the youth council with this protest, it might generate some leverage. Mm-hmm. And so Vel, which began to march with us when we go through the city, her husband would march with us, go through the city. We're picking up all these people. We make the decision to cross the 16th Street Viaduct because that was the biggest symbol of racism in Milwaukee, was that Mason-Dixon line. We're not to be over there in the first place. And so,
was anyone hesitant considering what you guys were up against?
We were on the same page. We had been prepped for that. We had decided, the commandos had sat down with a strategy for that. The youth council had planned, and we had got with Vel being that we got behind the idea that this would be a demonstration that we were coming over to where we didn't belong, that we were the symbol that Milwaukee belonged to us just like it did anybody else. And so the first night we went over there was on the 28th of August. We made that march over there, a few hundred of us. And when we got to the end of the bridge over to Kosciuszko Park, we were only met by a few whites calling names and you know, protesting. And it was a peaceful protest. The next night on the 29th, we went back. And when we got to the other side of that bridge, there were 13,000 or more white people over there. Clubs and bottles, they threw bricks at it. They did everything you could think of to us. And we made our way back across that bridge. And on the way, when we got back across the bridge, we found out that the police had firebombed or tear gassed the Freedom House and set the Freedom House on fire. They said that they thought there was some criminal or somebody that they were looking for. And a couple of young men, I know one of the young men got severely burned leaving there, but they burned the Freedom House. And all that did was incensed us to continue doing what we were doing.
What did the coordination for the marches look like?
As soon as we got that march together, the commandos would line the march on the outside and space themselves in different places. We had another group of commandos who would follow in different spots in cars, unmarked cars, because the police had a habit of attacking the march along with the people. And so the purpose of the commandos was to protect the march, protect those marchers, and also to keep those people from engaging in any violence. We were going to be nonviolent. We didn't carry weapons. But when we said nonviolent, we meant we would be nonviolent, but we would defend ourselves if need be. For 200 days, we continued to march. And the strategy was that if we continue marching like this, the police have to continue being with the march, they have to continue being out there, and it was costing the city money.
What was challenging about being a commando?
Even though we were commandos, and even though we resembled strong Black male leadership, you were kind of apprehensive when you went out on the march. Even though you were concerned for the marchers, you were concerned for yourself also. I had a wife at the time and a child still at home. So things on the march could affect my family. Many of the other marchers had family, and some of the younger members of the youth council, you had young people that were assaulted by grown-ups and by white people where they didn't do a thing about it. They didn't burn, they didn't loot, they just gritted their teeth. But we as commandos, some of us, we were kind of apprehensive. What's going to happen tonight? I remember the march on North, one night on North Avenue when they declared an unlawful assembly. I remember they were dispersing the mob, and I grabbed one young kid, grabbed him by the jacket and snatched him and took her. We ran around the corner of the church. It's right there on the corner of Fond du Lac and North. There was that big church there on that corner. We got to the corner and a policeman fired a shotgun at us. And it hit the corner of that building. Just as I went at the edge of that corner, fired a shotgun, they fired tear gas. And so you would go on the marches not knowing what to expect from the police. It's one thing, we knew what the crowd was gonna do when we got over there. We knew we were gonna face bricks and bottles and eggs, but you didn't know what the police were gonna do. It was 200 days of tension going back and forth across that bridge. But more importantly, out of those 200 days, we ended up with a camaraderie that was unbelievable. We would gather, we may have disagreements, some of the brothers and the commandos, because all people don't agree.
Right.
We may have some arguments, but on the whole, we were a brotherhood. We were close. We ate meals at that Freedom House. We planned strategies at that Freedom House. We laughed at that Freedom House. We enjoyed one another because we were all still young people. And those people in the youth council were all young people, but they were young people who had set their goals on making this law become a reality by helping Bell Phillips do what everybody opposed her in that city council.
Are you still in touch with past members? Do you guys still get together?
The few of us that are left, we reminisce about those days. Even though it was a struggle, it was a time of enjoyment. I'm reminded of the slaves and how they would gather, even though the slave master was so hard on them, that when they would get away to themselves, how they could enjoy what little bit of peace and comfort and time they had together.
I guess my final question would be, why is the NAACP Youth Council and the Commandos important to Milwaukee in history and in the present?
I think we've made an impact on the history of Milwaukee, past and present. For present, it shows you how steadfastness can generate positives. When you remain steadfast, decisions that you make, not decisions for yourself, but when you make a sacrifice for others, there's a blessing behind that. When we look back, if those youth council members had not decided to make a statement about what was happening to their lives, where would Milwaukee even be today? If people don't look around them, that's what those young people did. They looked around them and saw what their community was like. They lifted their voices to be heard. They did it not just by word, but they did it by deed. They decided that this is what we were going to do, and we're not going to let anything deter us or distract us from what we're doing. And I think today, if what young people are doing, the same thing, they're stepping up to the plate.
Joseph Baring is a former member of the NAACP Youth Council Commandos who participated in the Fair Housing Marches in Milwaukee. He spoke to WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. You can find more of our Black History Month coverage at WUWM.com, including a story about Joshua Glover, a man who escaped slavery and fled to Wisconsin for freedom. WUWM has been partnering with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee PBS, and the Milwaukee Public Library on an initiative we call Listen MKE. The latest Listen MKE focused on the massive spike in car thefts we've been seeing in the city. More than 1,000 cars were stolen in the first 40 days of the year, and car thefts are up 145% compared to this time last year. James Causey from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel moderated a conversation about carjackings on Tuesday. One of the guests was Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm, who explained the legal ramifications that people can face for stealing cars and the issues surrounding the justice system during the pandemic.
As a district attorney, can you explain to people the penalties for an adult carjacking someone as opposed to a juvenile with a weapon carjacking someone? what are the penalties and how do they differ?
Actually, the penalties are the same no matter what. And so what changes is the venue in which they are assessed and potentially prosecuted. And those systems are very, very different. So on the adult side, anybody 17 years of age and older is subject generally, the cases that are brought in on the adult side are generally some version of operating an auto without owner's consent. Our experience is that those are often attended with other crimes, such as fleeing the officers when the car is detected as being stolen. And oftentimes it's been stolen days or even weeks prior, but the Milwaukee Police Department keeps a list of every reported stolen car. And so at some point in time, they observe that car, they conduct a stop. What we have seen on the adult side is that there tend to be, there's a reasonable chance that it's going to result in a chase, and that once the person is apprehended, that there could be drugs, there could be guns, things of that nature. The on the juvenile side of things, with the young people that are involved in these, it's a very different system. And but the crime is the same, so we still have to prove the exact same elements. The difference being that the case is generally, it's not brought into the district attorney's office initially, which is the major distinction. And the adult side, the police bring the case directly to the DA's office under normal circumstances, and we'll have to talk about this is not normal circumstances by a long shot. The person is generally detained in the jail until we determine whether to charge the case or not. On the juvenile side, the case is always brought into to a social worker, a county social worker who screens that case and makes a determination whether the juvenile is going to be detained or not. And that's what leads to some of the misunderstanding that you hear from citizens and maybe even from some of your guests today, is that oftentimes the decision is made to release the child back to their family, to their guardian. And sometimes that case isn't even sent to us for review for up to 30 days. So that's a significant distinction that results in some you know, concerns. And we share those concerns you want to intervene as quickly as you can possibly intervene. And that intervention doesn't necessarily mean putting somebody in detention, but it does mean that you want to start addressing the problem as quickly as possible. But the reality is you're dealing with two very distinct systems in the juvenile side and on the adult side.
Do you work at all with the juvenile correction facility? Is there a lot of communication or is very little communication?
Yeah, so we communicate extensively with all the partners in the system. And you have to also understand that unlike the adult side of things, like for example, a probation agent is a state probation agent on the adult side. On the juvenile side, there are actually two forms of supervision. Some are county probation agents for the individuals that have not been sent, for example, to Lincoln Hills. It's not until after you've been sent to Lincoln Hills that you are then returned into the custody of a state probation agent. So, our current numbers at Lincoln Hills are, I believe, are below 20. We have a lot of resources for what I would call low to moderate risk kids in the Milwaukee area. We have next to nothing for high risk kids. And that's the problem from my perspective that urgently has to be addressed. And unfortunately, we've known this for a long time. Right. We know the conditions in Lincoln Hills are horrible. But the problem is when we were given the opportunity to address that problem, even though it came grossly under resourced, we didn't do anything with it. So at some point in time, you have to have options at the local level that will address the higher risk kids so that you can allow community based organizations to do the great work they do. But they're really not designed to deal with a kid like you're saying, a 12-year-old that's involved in this, or somebody that has repeat offenses. you're left with an all or nothing determination. You either send somebody to Lincoln Hills or you try to find a community-based option. And that's what frustrates people, particularly if the community-based option doesn't provide enough oversight and control.
I'm glad you brought up Lincoln Hills. So there's been some thought out there from certain people who have sent me messages saying that they want to know if there is an effort out there to work as hard as possible not to send you to Lincoln Hills because of Lincoln Hills' reputation. Is that true?
I think it plays a factor in the thinking that the actors responsible for making the decision have to consider. And that's why my strong advocacy several years ago was that we create smaller, community-based, but secure sites. You know, and by smaller, ideally, you would have no more than, 10 kids in a facility, and that you would have essentially a 2-to-1 ratio of staff to child. The advantage of that is that they can remain in the community, they can be closely monitored, they can be given the right interventions, but they can still stay in touch with their families. What we're doing right now simply doesn't work. And we know it doesn't work because when we send kids to Lincoln Hills, it's almost like the express ticket to the adult system. The failure rate out of the juvenile correction side is astronomical. I think Eric would tell you that police officers have long known that stealing cars is sort of the gateway. It's sort of the gateway crime to much deeper system involvement. And so it's a major concern. Now, I'll just have to add that look, we're not just in a public health crisis, right? We are in a public safety crisis in Milwaukee County. That's what makes us distinct from all the other 72 counties. The current system is operating at about 30 to 40% capacity. We only have 4 operating trial courts. You know, we had over 191 homicides last year, almost 800 non-fatal shootings. That doesn't count the sexual assaults, the armed robberies. It doesn't account for the domestic violence cases. Every single day in our one domestic violence court that's open right now, we have 20 to 30 jury trials set a day. The Milwaukee Police Department is spread about as thin as they can possibly be spread. We have 165 people awaiting homicide trial in the jail. So the backlog is immense. And from my standpoint, it is absolutely imperative that the state recognize that in order for us to effectively implement our crime control strategies, and we have done that in the past. We've implemented strategies that have shown real results and managed to reduce the violent crime, reduce the auto thefts. It's just incredibly difficult to do that right now when the system is effectively closed down. I know that law enforcement is eligible for vaccinations. You know that corrections is eligible for vaccinations. But public defenders, prosecutors, judges, They're not even listed in the next eligible groups. It could be June or July before those groups are eligible for vaccination. And in the meantime, you can predict that the numbers are going to continue to rise, and they have continued to rise. So it's a really serious crisis right now that I would encourage people to contact their state representatives and tell them that real attention needs to be paid to this issue so that we can get the system operating again.
John Chisholm is the Milwaukee County District Attorney. That was part of the latest Listen MKE event that took place on Facebook Live on Tuesday. Listen MKE is a partnership of WUWM, the Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Public Library, and Milwaukee PBS. You can find the full conversation at WUWM.com. Seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, can affect people during the winter months because of the lack of sunlight. Add on a pandemic and less time spent outdoors, and people can really suffer this time of year. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll tell you how you can fight off SAD. But first, we'll look at how the pandemic has affected Wisconsin's tribal gaming industry, and what it could mean for local governments. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The impact of the COVID-19 pandemic is seemingly endless, and there's yet another industry suffering because of it, tribal gaming. While gaming may not be top of mind for many during the pandemic, it's a major industry in Wisconsin. In 2019, casino revenues in the state totaled $1.3 billion. This past year, profits were down by nearly 82%, which means less money flowing into the state and local governments, like Wisconsin's tribal governments. Ari Brown is a researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, which reported on these losses and what it could mean for local governments. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about it.
How big is this industry in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the tribal gaming industry is quite big in Wisconsin. There are 11 individual tribes that have compacts with the state. Just focusing on kind of the revenue end here, in our report, we look at something called net win, which is essentially what each of those 11 tribes takes home before providing any revenue, any share of that back to the state. And in 2019, that was $1.3 billion. And that is just from what's called Class 3 games, which is just a small slice of all tribal gaming. So, you know, it's a potentially multi-billion dollar industry. The state only sees a very small percentage of that, but it is quite a large industry.
Well, and with such a large industry, even if they're just seeing a bit of that, it seems like it's going to make a big impact.
Yeah. So in our report, we focus on what goes back to the state from that small proportion of net win. Typically in a year, you know, before the pandemic, it would be somewhere probably between $50 and $60 million, with about half of that going to appropriations to specific departments and the other half going to the general fund. So, you know, when we talk about the general fund, it's typically somewhere between $18 and $19 billion. It's quite large, and this is only a small proportion of it, but it's still substantial, and especially substantial to local governments who are in agreements with these tribal governments as well.
We'll get back to local governments in just a moment. But, you know, a big part of this conversation is, of course, that this money, most of it, is going back to tribes in most cases, it seems. Where does that money go in general?
Yeah, unfortunately, we weren't able to obtain, you know, individual budgets from tribal governments. They're, you know, not subject to the same kind of public information laws as like a municipal or county government would be. But in some conversations that we had with tribal government leaders and lobbyists, they made quite clear that this is a really important facet of their budget, especially for certain tribes. We talked to the Forest County Potawatomi, who, as listeners might know, operate a large casino in Milwaukee. They're a relatively small tribe compared to certain other tribes located in Wisconsin. And so the Potawatomi Casino in Milwaukee does provide a substantial stream of revenue to the Forest County Potawatomi. And so you can imagine that it would have a really large impact on just that tribe's basic daily functioning. You know, with the time that we had to produce this report, we weren't able to talk to all 11 tribes. I think probably a lot of Wisconsinites are more familiar with tribes like the Oneida, the Potawatomi, and Madison, the Ho-Chunk have a presence. But there are, you know, 11 total tribes that have compacts with the state. And for many of them, they operate, you know, a couple of small casinos scattered across like northwestern Wisconsin. And, you know, to the extent that those casinos are a big, you know, proportion of their budget, it's going to kind of depend on the tribe. But all 11 state compacts that tribes have with the state, they all operate Class 3 gaming. They all, you know, obtain a substantial amount of revenue from it. In addition to the revenue that goes to the general fund, kind of the first bucket that these compacts pay for in terms of revenue to the state is these individual appropriations. They go to, you know, individual departments of the state government, but that goes right back into tribal communities. So in addition to, you know, all of the other things that are kind of hidden behind, you know, the state only sees a small proportion of net win, the tribes are receiving the rest of that net win, and we know that number is way down. But in addition to that, the state receiving less of that revenue also means that these individual programs are potentially not funded to the full extent that they might be in a normal year. So kind of the big ones being tourism and travel, natural resources, justice, health. These are all really important programs for the tribes. Like there's a tribal language revitalization grant in here. There's, you know, a focus on tourism marketing, things that are kind of multipliers in terms of the tribes seeing revenue. You know, if they're able to pay the state to provide this general tourism marketing help. That's more tourism marketing. That's more people traveling to kind of tribal regions, and that's going back into the community. So yeah, it's going to impact all of them.
We've talked a bit about the financial loss, but when there's a financial loss, there is also a big loss in jobs. So far, what has that looked like?
Right. So we kind of talk about two instances of that. In the report, we mentioned that the Potawatomi Hotel and Casino in Milwaukee, which is, as you mentioned, the state's largest casino, was closed from mid-March to around June 8th and laid off about 1,600 workers, which is more than half of its workforce. Now, of course, not all of those are, you know, members of the Potawatomi tribe, but you can imagine it kind of underscores the extent to which the casino itself is losing revenue and is operating at a loss. We also mentioned that the Oneida Nation's Green Bay Casino and facilities were closed for about 2 months back towards the beginning of the pandemic. Their employment dropped, I believe, also by a little bit more than half. And now all of these casinos are not even necessarily closed at this point, but are operating in the same way that restaurants might or movie theaters might, where even if they are open, there's, you know, enough kind of skepticism out there, and people are still kind of wary enough of the pandemic that there's just a huge drop in attendance, which is going to lead to a drop in revenue that goes back to these individual tribes.
It is an industry that really depends on people feeling comfortable in that space, being able to go into a casino most often. When we're looking at local governments in particular, you know, we know how the state government works, but there's a lot of different streams of money that are coming into the state government. For local governments, that's not always the case. How are they faring?
Yeah, so we talk about just a couple in here. For the most part, the compacts that these tribes have are with the state. A couple of them spell out specifically individual kind of deals with local governments. We mentioned for the Potawatomi, obviously, a deal with the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. But we also mentioned with the Oneida, they have deals with Brown and Outagamie counties, as well as the village of Ashwaubenon, the city of Green Bay, and the town of Oneida. So for those individual governments, especially when you're talking about not even the bigger cities, but the smaller, like the town of Oneida, I believe there's also certain northern counties, I believe Bayfield and Ashland County would be on that list. But when you're talking about smaller local governments, there's certainly the chance for these to be, you know, substantial impacts. When there is a compact in place, it's a substantial loss of revenue to certain local governments for sure.
Casinos, like a lot of the industries you mentioned before, like restaurants, any place that you have to be out in public to really enjoy, they've had a hard time during this pandemic. They're going to continue to have a hard time until people really feel safe. And for these other industries, we've been talking about different kinds of bailouts, at least different kinds of ways to support these industries. Are we seeing these same conversations happening around casinos and gambling?
Yeah, so, you know, even with some sort of, you know, bailout or, you know, some sort of stimulus revenue, just because of the nature of how a casino works, it's going to be difficult to get back to the levels that we were at before the pandemic. And I think another really important facet of this conversation is, in the past, there have been certain instances of certain tribes withholding their payment due to some sort of disagreement. This happened last in 2014, but then that amount was repaid in 2015. The tribes might not have the revenue to make those repayments in the future. We kind of mentioned towards the beginning of the report that there's going to be, like, over the course of 2020, 2021, and 2022, about a $70 million gap in revenue going towards the state. And it's just not clear that even with, you know, conversations of stimulus, that there's going to be enough to eventually repay that. There's just so much uncertainty right now as to when operations in a casino are going to look like they were prior to March of 2020.
Ari Brown is a researcher for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find a link to the forum's report on the pandemic's impact on Wisconsin's tribal gaming industry at WUWM.com. Feel like you have the winter blues? Well, it's hard not to in Wisconsin, but you could also be impacted by seasonal affective disorder.
3% of Americans are affected with SAD. In Wisconsin, we're looking at about 6%. In New Hampshire, it's about almost 10%.
We'll learn more about SAD for our Fit for You. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's February, which means people's seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, can be peaking. SAD is a kind of cyclical depression related to the changes in season. Shorter days with less sunlight can increase fatigue, and the urge to withdraw can hit even harder. Millions of American adults may suffer from SAD, although many may not realize it. Symptoms can range from feeling like you have the winter blues to severe depression, as is more common the farther north you live, like in Wisconsin. This season, we also have to add the challenges of living through a pandemic. To learn more about SAD and to offer some tips to help treat it, Janice Ells, UW-Milwaukee Professor of Biomedical Sciences, joins me for this month's Fit for You. She begins by explaining the varying degrees of SAD people can experience.
For most people that have seasonal affective disorder, it sort of comes in different degrees. There's sort of the winter blues where you just notice that you're a little more down. And then there are people who really have the diagnosis of seasonal affective disorder. And then there are people who are much more depressed and actually need therapeutic intervention. I can speak to it quite personally and viscerally because I have suffered from seasonal affective disorder, and members of my family suffer from seasonal affective disorder. So I can really speak to all the symptoms and the treatments.
Well, and with such a range, and you mentioned, of course, it's kind of in a seasonal time, I imagine it was hard to recognize seasonal affective disorder. So when did it start being diagnosed and recognized, especially if, you know, it's a range of, oh, I feel, you know, the winter blues compared to really bad depressive episodes?
It actually goes back to, as I recall, I think it was like the late 50s, maybe mid 60s. It was a South African native, a guy by the name of Norman Rosenthal, because he moved from Johannesburg, which was very sunny at a wonderful warm latitude, to complete his psychiatric residency in New York City. And he actually recognized that he was suffering from this and helped pioneer the use of light therapy, of phototherapy, sitting in front of a high output lamp for about a half an hour. And then he went on to do a lot of work at the National Institutes of Health. And it took quite a while to convince people that the length of day, the amount of sunlight you got, the amount of light that you were exposed to actually had anything to do with mood. Again, it was sort of an uphill battle, but he's quite well respected now. And we actually recognize the causes now, and we can explain seasonal affective disorder much better.
So I appreciate you sharing your personal history and your family's history with seasonal affective disorder, otherwise known as SAD. So I imagine it's pretty prevalent. You know, is this considered a common disorder? I mean, we're in Wisconsin where we experience very different winter seasons compared to elsewhere in the country and the world. But is this pretty prevalent no matter where you live?
It affects about 3% of the population, and it's not only just winter. There's actually a summer SAD. There's sort of a weird variant, and that really has to go with the, as we'll can get into this later, with the hormones in your brain. But 3% of Americans are affected with SAD. In Wisconsin, we're looking at about 6%. In New Hampshire, it's about almost 10%. In Florida, it's 1.4%. So it clearly has a lot to do with the length of day, with where you are in the hemisphere. So people along the equator don't generally suffer from SAD. About 10% of people can have sort of more mild cases, as I said, this winter blues. Women are more often diagnosed than men, but if we dig in and ask the appropriate questions, the incidence does not have a sex difference. It's just that women are more likely to admit that they have something that's affecting their mood than men are.
Yeah, so is this something that's relatively low risk to self-diagnose? You know, noticing like, okay, it's winter blues, but when should we think a little bit further than, oh, I'm just in a funk?
Well, one of the first things that usually happens, and this is classic with any kind of depression, seasonal depression and other depression, is your sleep cycle changes. And that also changes in the winter. I mean, basically we become like, you know, big old bears. We want to go hibernate. We sleep longer, but we're not really refreshed when we get up. And so the physical symptoms that really precede the mood shift include, you know, sleeping in more, daytime fatigue, craving for carbohydrates and weight gain. So, you know, sort of all the things you kind of associated with, you know, the holidays and things. And then once the depression hits, the symptoms are pretty much the same as non-seasonal depression. They're lack of motivation, reduced social contact, anxiety, and then they lift again. I mean, I can say from my own experience with it, I really didn't notice the depressive aspect until usually almost February and or late January or so. I would notice that I was sleeping more, but and then the thing that used to just spring me out of it is that every spring over spring break, we would go down to the Caribbean, and that blast of sunshine was amazing. Now, once I sort of sorted this out, figured it out for myself, I got a high 1000 lux light, and we can talk about those. And that worked great, just 30 minutes of light in the morning or getting up and getting outside. So it does, I mean, pretty much all depression is cyclical. The nice predictable thing about seasonal affective disorder is that as those days lengthen, and actually you can avoid it entirely if you can push yourself to get up, adjust your sleep time, go outside, use a light, you know, if it's very severe, psychotherapy. I'm a pharmacologist, but for seasonal affective disorder, I would say antidepressant should probably be the last course of action. I'm not a big fan. I think that exercise and light therapy works quite well and doesn't have any side effects.
So you mentioned light therapy. What kind of lights are these specifically that people use to combat SAD?
Okay, these are very bright lights. They put out 10,000 lux, which is now, so lux is a measure of illumination or light. If you went out on a bright sunny day, you would be exposed to about 50,000 lux of sunlight. So 10,000 is bright, and you don't look right at these lights. You just set them, you know, you can put them off to the side. Verilux is a company that's been around for a long, long time, but there's a lot of good lights. But now that we can play with light emitting diodes, people are starting to play with different colors and promoting different colors, and the science is way behind. So I would say, as someone who has had SAD, who has read a lot about it, you are better off to go with the old fashioned 1000 lux light box. Or alternatively, and I think this works pretty much as well, put on your jacket and get yourself outside for 30 minutes to an hour every day. Even in the cloudy weather, you're probably getting 25, 30,000 lux. And the sunlight bouncing off the snow, you're probably getting about 75. So.
Well, that's good to know. And even noting that even on a cloudy day, you know, it's still good to try and get yourself outside. And of course, the coronavirus pandemic has kept us indoors more and more. And I'll admit, working from home, it's really easy to realize 2-3 days later, like, oh, I haven't gone outside once, you know, in this whole stretch of time. So how has the pandemic impacted seasonal affective disorder?
It's a double, triple whammy. It's basically the COVID fatigue, which is depressing in and of itself, diminished holidays, the lack of social interactions, all of those, you know, combine or conspire towards depression. And then the other thing is, you're absolutely right, and I have the same problem. There are days I sit in front of my computer all day, pretty much with meetings and teaching and all of that, and I realize it's getting dark before I've had a chance to get outside. And we're getting far too much blue light all day. So we are basically designed to be outside, to get blue light in the morning, to start getting yellow, green, red light in the afternoons, and more towards deep red light in the evening. And that prompts us towards sleep. And that's not happening now, because we're all, even before the pandemic, we were all staring at our screens too much. And now we're really staring at our screens a lot.
So as we try to, you know, alter our habits and some, you know, winter's hard sometimes, but what are some simple steps you'd recommend that people can start today to help combat SAD?
One of the things I would recommend is actually, because this whole thing is linked in terms of your biological clock, your circadian rhythm, so that gets messed up. Serotonin in your brain, the drop in serotonin, affects mood and could play a role in SAD. And this is how most antidepressants work, as they try to boost the serotonin back up. But exercise does the same thing, and so does getting out in the sunlight. And melatonin is also involved in this. And the whole way that light triggers all of this is very complex. And I would say we still don't have it completely figured out. But we do know that vitamin D is very important. And we're very likely to be D deficient in Wisconsin. And taking as much as, you know, several thousand units a day, you can trust me as a pharmacologist, you will not develop hypervitaminosis. You will not get detoxic. I take 5,000 units a day. And the last time I had my vitamin D checked, it was just middling. You know, it wasn't, when I went in the first time, it was low. And in fact, one of my primary care docs said that just about everyone she tested was low to, you know, really deficient. So vitamin D, and vitamin D also is an antidepressant. It has antidepressant properties. It has behavioral properties. So that helps. Getting out and walking, exercise helps. Trying to avoid and this one is really hard for me, staying away from your tablet, your TV, and all of that. You know, read a chapter in a book the last half hour of the day, and really work hard on establishing a regular sleep-wake pattern. One of the things that every psychiatrist checks with a depressed patient is, how are you sleeping? That's the first thing they ask you when they come in. As you're recovering, it's one of the things you ask. I can tell you as a depressed patient that it's when your sleep comes back, your depression lifts. So really, you can work to normalize it. Talk to people. It's that old, you know, talk to your mates, and don't let yourself get isolated. That's a big part of depression as well. And be kind to yourself.
Janice Ells is a professor of biomedical sciences at UW-Milwaukee's College of Health Sciences. She spoke with me about seasonal affective disorder for this month's Fit for You. Next week, we'll feature an interview with local poet Richard Hederman about his latest book called Choosing a Stone. For today, we'll leave you with a little preview of some of his work. Here's Hederman reading the Insomniac's poem.
I can't sleep, but you know that already. Instead, I lie awake on a bed of nails, one ear swaddled in the pillow's cauldron, tossing in razor grass. The world has stopped. It listens to my heartbeat in the impenetrable hangman's quiet. The clock nails down the hatch on another minute, the gate slammed shut on another opportunity, now consigned to someone more deserving. The digits are bright splinters of time, green as lichen on night's mute wall. Mice scratch in the puzzle of night. How fragile the world, how tiny, how flat sleeps tundra and without landmarks. Nothing near or far, but somewhere a grave is being prepared. Somewhere there is a fork in the night, a place where the path divides and a choice must be made. I have never reached that place. Instead, I am trying to sleep as night erodes, leaving only another dawn and the light that will once again illumine an inexplicable city.
That was Richard Hederman reading the Insomniac's poem. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers joins me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayon Silver, Emily Files, and Taryn Powell from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Trevor Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday for a conversation with the director of the documentary Growing Up Milwaukee. And Bubbler Talk explores the annexation of the Granville Township. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.